Bienvenue à la balado-diffusion sur Radio Créon du colloque sur le rapport Taylor-Bouchard qui s'est tenu à Montréal en mai 2009. Welcome to the audio podcast on Radio Créon of the conference on the Bouchard-Taylor report that took place in Montreal in May 2009.
Voilà le relais, Jean-Claude Tremblay approuve Richard qui cherche mot de l'œil. La passe est ici, il est seul. Il lance.
Vous allez voir ça, vous allez nous aimer.
So I'm not sure exactly what form my question's going to take, but so I just want to say that I really appreciated Monique's presentation, and I want to challenge Jacob a little bit more, though with my kind of interpretation of something that Monique said. And I guess I really don't have a mind for a real politique that you seem to have here. So you seem to really be trying to think about what can actually be done by the report and how it's going to affect elections and all of these things. And that's a little bit beyond me. But I thought that what was really compelling about what Monique was saying was that this discourse about religious practices is actually a form of neo-racism, such that one can be racist without ever using the words race and without using certain kinds of words. So in fact, you know, as we've seen repeatedly since 9/11, that one can, in the guise of feminism, be racist. So, or in the guise of certain kinds of enlightenment, secularist discourse, actually give voice to certain kinds of racist passions and et cetera. And so, what I thought was interesting was the way that you seemed to suggest that the report actually reproduces this very racism in its own language and in its own differentiation between us and them. And it seems to me that even if that's going to maybe have certain kinds of political effects that that might be good, that this is a real problem, that it's allowed to sort of reflect and reproduce and entrench this kind of neo-racism in the guise of enlightenment, secularism, and even and feminism, and sort of paternalist concerns for women's well-being that never has to face up to its racism.
Well, let me just say, I think it would take a lot of political courage and a lot of political will that I think maybe just wasn't present to open up the issues in this more radical way. And I don't know where it would lead to, honestly, but just to, I mean, you've certainly represented my position, just to make a quick comment on Jacob's commentary. I think that if your goal is to quell the anxieties of French Quebecers, the commission did a very good report. If your goal is social justice, then as I've said, it did not succeed. And I've heard in the last couple of days accounts from some of you about the various groups who were not given an audience with the Taylor-Bouchard Commission, groups of, I think Eleanor was giving examples of like Filipino workers who wanted to meet with the commission, but there wasn't enough space in the schedule, and all these other social justice groups that are also racial minorities and suffering injustice. All the examples that I gave are of, Algerians and Moroccans, all of whom have degrees. They were handpicked by the Quebec government to come here. They all have degrees, work experience, and they're all unemployed. I mean, all the ones obviously in the report were. So I don't know that the bureaucratic mechanisms alone are going to get anywhere near to the heart of the issue, because and many of them had their degrees recognized already, and they still couldn't get jobs because they're greeted with employers who don't think that their degrees have the same value as Quebecois degrees and Quebecois work experience, and that kind of endemic racism, I think, is not going to be touched by the report. So I would challenge Jacob's account of the report sort of doing a good job within the narrow scope that it sort of set out.
The whole idea or your propositional statement, the conflict is about religious practices, I thought that her paper challenged that claim, that it might actually be about race, even though it takes the language of conflict about religion.
Okay, let me say these two things. One is that Enlightenment secularism is going to be a funny way to describe the enterprise of Charles Taylor. There was, in the months after the report, something that looks a whole lot more like what your question described. I'm going to get the name wrong, the Fédération Québécoise des Femmes proposed a resolution that for a while looked like the government was going to endorse, to amend the Quebec Charter of Rights to expressly subordinate religious freedom to sex equality. That is this strange kind of enlightenment, secular feminism qua racism. But notice, not subordinating race equality to sex equality, subordinating religious freedom to sex equality. There was a targeting of religion in the proposal. I was astonished and relieved that the government ended up putting through something that was really anodyne. But that's not the report. That's something that is significantly to the reports, if this is the right direction to talk about it, left. And the report, to some degree, may have staved off things like that. The second thing about race and religious conflict, and my thinking of it as really having been a panic about religious practices and not race, race politics tends to be at its rawest up close. It tends to be the case that really racialized conflict, and there's going to be no way to solve the epistemic problem in this proposition, but racialized conflicts tend to be very up-close conflicts that are, as it were, worst in the multiracial city. There was so much of this panic that was driven by a hinterland where no practitioner of the relevant practice had ever set foot, that it really did seem to be an obsession about things that people did, not something that would touch more generally on the fact that, well, those cities are filled with people who are differently colored. It was a strange set of obsessions, but it was a set of obsessions that was, on its surface, it was about religion, and I don't see any way to look below the surface and see that that was really a mask for something else, because if it was a mask for something else, it had so little to do with something else. The commission hearings got so much better, not great, but so much better when things came to Montreal, that it looked to me not like what I as an American think of as a deeply racialized racist conflict, where things would get much, much worse as people were talking about their immediate conflicts with their immediate neighbors. Things were so much at their worst in the Laurentians and in the more rural areas than that still, and the obsessions were with religious practices that people might never have seen. But never having seen them, I have no reason to think that their obsession with them was about the skin color of the people they hadn't seen doing them.
I'll start with this question that was asked by you. I think that, you know, to ask what was the conflict or the discussion really about is not the right question to ask. You know, was it really about race or really about religious practices? I think it was about many different things. And I think we have to remember, in fairness to the commission, that its mandate, that it already enlarged its mandate, because its mandate was, at the beginning, just to inquire about reasonable accommodation. And so that really set the stage for a focused discussion about the kind of accommodation with religious practices. And it's the commission itself that decided to give a wide interpretation of its mandate. And this first decision was criticized by a lot of people, including by people like me, who thought that it was going to make things completely unmanageable for the commission. And there was a point where we really thought that we were going into a catastrophe, you know, socially, because of this widening of the debate. So if the commission has said, not only are we going to extend this to all kinds of different difficulties, but we are going to talk about race, I think it would have made, you know, it would have been fun, perhaps, but I don't think it would have been a very wise decision. But I am really interested by what you said about... So I agree that one of the problems of framing the issue through reasonable accommodation is that you really have... I really liked the expression that you used, the supplicant-respondent model. And I think that that's certainly a problem. Because you put minorities in this permanent role of being a supplicant, and you put the majority in the role of saying, well, how should we respond to this other demand? And I think that's certainly not a very good thing politically. But I was wondering how talking about race would make that, would change that? Would it change that? Because then you have anti-discriminatory legislation. How does that change that particular issue? So that would be my question to Monique. And I have also a question to Jeff. I thought it was very interesting to say that you can decide to frame the issue either as a matter of conscience, and that's more in the Protestant tradition, or as a matter of community practices. And community practices are perhaps easier to handle because it's easier to see how you could make compromises and how you can better understand. But I think that one of the problems that we see is that for many religious groups, or that's my impression, is that some religious groups are really in between because they are also being influenced by the fact that they are in the West, and that it's becoming more and more difficult to see if it's a question of adhering to a community practice or if it's a question of saying, this is what I believe and this is how I want to, and I have to be loyal to this particular belief. And I think that it's true, I see it also as a problem in the report that they have this tendency to go, you know, freedom of conscience, freedom of religion, and as if we're all little Lockeans or Luther had the Diet of Worms saying, you know. But it seems to me that one of the problems that many believers are somewhere in between. So there is this loyalty to community practices, but there's also this dimension of conscience. And so I think this flux, and I think that makes it difficult how to better frame some of those problems. And so just the last comment, and then I'll shut up. I think that it's easy to say, you know, those persons in Quebec that were worrying about what was going on in terms of sex equality, they're just hidden racists. I think that that's really too simplistic. I think that there are real, very real worries that have to be addressed. And so I, you know, because I think that... I mean, for me, those are important issues. So I think it's too easy, and I wouldn't consider myself a racist. So maybe I am, you know. But I think it's a difficult discussion, but we have to have a real discussion. Oh.
So I agree with you, actually, that, and it has a couple of effects that when religions from other places come to the West, they do start taking on this language. That's, I think, a common and unsurprising occurrence. It also might mean that they might become more belief-based and less practice-based. So I think you're right, that the belief-practice dichotomy can easily be overdrawn. But let me say why I like the idea, let me elaborate a little bit, that if it's a matter of laws and rules are always changeable in a way that, I mean, conscience is changeable too, but conscience has a stronger feel to it than me. And, you know, we're more reluctant to change someone's conscience, but there are different legal traditions, and when you put religions in different situations, that comes up with a need for new interpretations of the law. And so the law is and practices are more of a moving body. So it's not that I regret or bemoan this fuzzing of the distinction. I do think it happens, but I do think there's an advantage to practice. And it's also the case that, you know, the Mormons, polygamy was outlawed, and then a few years later it turned out that according to their beliefs, they didn't have to be polygamists. Lo and behold, they changed their mind on this. So there is a way in which, you know, the state can, in fact, change practices and then beliefs follow in a certain kind of way. You know, I mean, sometimes what we do informs what we believe instead of the opposite. So all this is not a way to disagree with what you're saying, because I think you're right, and that just may make the challenge a little more difficult. Particularly, and this is the last thing I say about it, when we have, I think, what's called the subjective view of conscience, where the courts are no longer going to determine whether it's a part of a community practice or not. I mean, one of the advantages of community practices is that you have this easy integrity test. You know, does the community practice X? But once you go to the subjective move, whereas if you believe that it's important, that's all that's important. I mean, you know, the question is, Dan, I was talking about this yesterday in a different form, whether you're down a slippery slope or not. And I don't think you necessarily are. I don't think this necessarily will mean you'll get lots and lots of claims. But if you did, you'd have to worry about it. I wouldn't worry about it until you did, and then I worry about it a lot. I want to see if it really happened. But that would be the worry. So the community gives you an easy integrity test in a way that the individual move to conscience doesn't. And so people will have different interpretations of all kinds. And it's not just different interpretations. Is that at least in the religion I'm most familiar with, Judaism? You know, my cynical belief is that there's a move, and I think this happens in many religions, of a view among certain believers to be more pure than the next. In other words, they want to go above and past the traditional law and prove themselves, you know, more pure than other people. And that, if you combine it with this individual move, the subjective move, could potentially cause some problems in a way that, you know, could be a problem. But, you know, let's wait and see. So I see what you're saying. I agree with you. You know, we'll see if it's a worry or not, but it might be.
Thanks for your comment, Dominique. I certainly appreciate that the commission did expand its mandate, you know, beyond what it originally was, and I think that that was a crucial first step. Although, as I've said, I wish that they had gone even further. You asked, though, how would race have changed the supplicant-respondent relationship? I mean, this is just a very general answer, but instead of asking minority groups to present their issues in terms of specific accommodation requests, you know, resource bases, as Jacob mentioned, I think the commission would then start one step back, maybe a different kind of commission. So asking, in this case, this example that I've been using, asking immigrant groups, well, what is your experience of Quebec society with respect to the question of integration? So, you know, not specifically what do you need to integrate in that workplace or that school, but what is your experience of it, and what do you think you'd need in order to feel more a part of the Quebec social fabric, you know, because otherwise you do end up getting these kind of counterfactual and not very useful solutions at times. So, for example, the report, one of the recommendations in the I can't remember if it was the section on harmonization, if it's specific harmonization practices, or the recommendation that for a body that would mediate the disputes, but also letting, you know, managers and those responsible for, you know, for the situation, like teachers and so on, giving them clearer guidelines. But in my view, you give them clearer guidelines and you don't challenge, you know, racist, like endemic racist practices and attitudes, then you very well may not get to, you know, the heart of the issue at all. And that can create, in fact, a kind of backlash, I think, where you're empowering people on the ground in those situations. Without, you know, telling managers, here are the guidelines, but you do what you want. We get over the legalization, the juridical route entirely, and then there's less protection in the absence of a franker discussion about racism and just racialization and of, you know, what that baseline culture needs to look like. So,
one thing about the supplicant respondent model. I mean, the hearings were so centered outside the cities, and all of the reasons that you pointed to for as it were, the absence of non-white and immigrant and minority voices, that also meant that the sociology of who was the supplicant isn't quite what it looks like when you read a narration of court cases in which the commission was not sitting as judge. That is, the commission went out and asked a whole lot of white Francophone Quebecois, what is it that you are so afraid of? And it was the white Francophone Quebecois who had to stand there, and if standing there and expressing one's wishes and anxieties is the act of a supplicant, then it was white Francophone Quebecois who were constantly put into the position of being a supplicant. The court cases that came before were not the doing of the commission, nor were the court cases, I think, intrinsically subordinating or supplicating. The standard move is something like, well, the Muslim woman prison guard goes to work one day wearing her hijab, and then she is told that she must take it off or she must go home, and then she goes to court to, in my liberal legalistic language, vindicate her rights. But she does not ask for permission first. The girl goes to the soccer game first. The paying customers make their arrangement with the manager of the sugar shack first. Then there's some kind of response. And in the wake of the response, one wishes for an accommodation. But the first thing that happens is that people try to lead their lives. People try to live their religious practices. And then someone else, the other customers at the sugar shack or the managers of the prison or the soccer coach or whoever, says no. Then one seeks an accommodation, and then the commission comes along and tells a story about all of the accommodation requests. But that doesn't mean that the dynamic of the commission was very much like individual religious believers coming and asking Charles Taylor for permission to practice their religions. No, but they did not appear as supplicants in this process.
Eleanor Lépinard from University of Montreal. So I don't know if I'm going to have you agree on the race issue, but I think, at least I might throw in, that I think part of the problem is you're not talking about the same concept of race, I think. And because, for example, Jacob, you said religion wasn't the mask for something else, and there was nothing about color in that discussion. But race is not about color. Okay, so I explain. If you take the work of Étienne Balibar, the French philosopher, and his work on racism really clearly explained, first, that racism used to be about biology, then it became about culture, but that the underlying logic is always the logic of segregation. That's the heart of how racism works in a society. And if you say that, then you can totally say that the whole discourse on religion in the report is actually a discourse about segregation and majority versus minority and not being polluted by these new practices. So you can totally say that it is actually maybe reinstating, reproducing a form of racism. But the content of that racism has changed, but the mechanism is the same. And so I find myself very much in agreement with what Monique was saying about the anxiety. I think one of the problems with the discourse of social anxiety in the report is that it legitimates this social anxiety because it says, oh, it's normal anxiety about cohesion. But if you turn the table around and say, oh, it sounds like the anxiety of the privileged group that looks that its privilege is going to be debunked, then it sounds like, you know, aristocrats during the French Revolution were pretty anxious, probably. And it's also, I mean, it's the same that happens in Quebec about feminism. I mean, the white male privilege has been unsettled and you have a strong masculinist movement. They are very anxious. They are very anxious and they are reacting because they know privileges are being debunked. So then you can maybe talk about social anxiety, but the social process and the power relation that you actually see beyond this anxiety is quite different than the discourse that the report expresses. So I don't know if I'm distorting everything you were saying, but I think that's a very important point. The second question is for Jeff. I'm very sympathetic to the idea that Protestantism is not only the spirit of capitalism, but also maybe of liberalism. So maybe we need a Max Weber book, but on that other side. And that's perfect. sounds good. And in France, Marcel Gauchet also argued for Catholicism, that Catholicism was the religion of the exit of religion. So it's the same kind of a specificity of that religion in the framework of liberalism. But then it seemed to me that your answer to that is maybe ambivalent, so I wanted to have you talk a little bit more on that. On one hand, you said, well, there is the issue of practice that comes up, and it blurs or it unsettles, it troubles the boundary between public and private and the definition of religious freedom that we have in liberalism. So that seemed to me that it was going on the road that maybe then the liberal framework has to be rethought thoroughly, or we need, like the feminist critique, what it did for the public-private debate and all divide and all this kind of stuff. But then on another hand, you said, oh, then it's going to be an issue about what's compatible or what's incompatible, and that's more, and you said respect practices, so it's more a discourse of tolerance that is totally in the framework of liberalism. So what's your, where do you stand, really?
You're right about what I said about color, and I knew as soon as that was out of my mouth that that was wrong. That's not true to the complicated understanding of race that's going on. I think I can still stand by the rest of what I said. But.
You know, my silence is because I'm not quite sure. I mean, I can tell you my instincts on this, which is to say that there are certain kind of bedrock egalitarian liberal principles that I'm reluctant to give up, but not necessarily always. I mean, but in a sort of a usual, let's say, immigrant framework, I do think in the end. So, I mean, you're right. We can go about it two ways. We can say, let's rethink this division. How are we going to accept practices that may not fit in the liberal framework? Or we can say, well, we're going to enlarge our view of religious freedom a little bit to accept certain kinds of public practices as long as they do not violate certain bedrock liberal principles. And this change might be more of a psychological change on the majority of society, accepting they're not used to people wearing certain kinds of clothing, whether it's clothing in public, or, so on and so forth, and they may have to do that. And I'm probably inclined toward the latter, but I don't want to commit myself necessarily to that without thinking about it a little more thoroughly. I mean, I do think. Let me give you an example from a different context. If we think of India, for example, so one of the things that happens in India is that certain lower castes are not allowed to enter into temples. And you know, if that happened in America, you would say, or in Canada, or liberal side, you say, well, you know, a religion is a private association. You know, they just do what they want, right? If they don't allow, you know, if Muslims don't allow, you know, Christians into the mosque at prayer time, that's just allowed. And if Christians don't allow Jews, or whatever, you know, you don't make that a big deal. Now, India outlawed this discrimination, although it's not something that they actually follow very often in practice, because it was pervasive and it was all the temples, almost every temple did this. And so I think in that kind of context, our liberal principles don't actually grapple with the problem. They really can't deal with that situation. So I guess as I talk, I'm thinking, I guess the question is, and this goes back to Dominique's question really, is can these non-Western religions change enough so they fit into the liberal framework or not? Right? Or does the liberal framework have to change to accommodate them? Right. No, you're right, but I don't have a good answer. You're right to push me on this, and I can't right now give you a good answer.
So two things, one prompted by Jeff's remarks and one the broader issues that Jacob brought up, but it touches on Monique as well. I mean, it's a small remark, actually. Just it's remarkable to me that you said that the report sort of assumed a kind of reasonableness about integration and stuff, and it doesn't really talk about or take into account the cases in which what people want is not to integrate with a little bit of a, you know, an allowance for their particular, you know, headdress or whatever. It doesn't take into account the ones who just don't want to integrate. I mean, the sneaking suspicion I have is that people care less about those types of issues. If they want to go off on their own and just do whatever, it's when they start coming into contact with us and inflecting practices that we see in a certain way in ways that we find offensive. And they could be things as trivial as, you know, people going to the sugar shack and not having pork in their pork and beans. I mean, what more sacred thing is there in Quebec than pork and beans at sugar shacks, right? I mean, you know, somebody pointed this out yesterday. There was a... the same media outlets that sort of whipped up the frenzy a couple of years ago tried to do a little bit of whipping a few weeks ago with Jewish groups. They turned out were running their own schools completely under the radar with absolutely no connection with the Ministry of Education guidelines and stuff like that, and, you know, educating kids as if they were in the, you know, 17th century Polish shtetl or something. And, you know, it's a problem. These kids are being deprived of an education that they're going to need in order to... Nobody cares, right? Nobody cares. It's like, you know, they do what they want. It's when they rub up against us that we... that's just, by the way. Second issue has to do with this whole mandate scope of the report thing. I mean, as people know, I was on the advisory committee of the report, and there was a big, big debate at the beginning about what the mandate, how the mandate should be framed. So something that happened before the consultations, which didn't get much media attention, was the commissioners went out and they went to hospitals and they went to schools and they went to, you know, courts and they went to all the public institutions where accommodation happens. They talked to the people at the, Commission des droits de la personne et de la jeunesse, and they said, how are things going? And the answer they got was, yeah, going pretty good. You know, there's always some, you know, some problems, but what they saw was a great deal of goodwill, creativity and ingeniousness in coming up with ways. I mean, you know, there's a school in Ville-Saint-Laurent that has something like 58 national groups and, you know, 72 mother tongues, and you know, it's actually, you know, you could just sit there and watch people in their everyday lives sort of, it's not perfect, and it's kind of, you know, sometimes it, you know, probably does end up advantaging the majority, but, you know, it sort of works. And then they came back and they said, okay, what do we do? You know, there isn't a problem, you know. It's going to be a really short report. Now, I was part of the minority and ultimate losing opinion that said, good, you know, good. Your mandate, after all, you know, very important. And this is not just a question of strategy. It's a question of democratic legitimacy. You are given a mandate by the government, which is in turn elected by the citizens, to do a thing, X. And if you do a thing, Y, and you make recommendations on those things, Y, there is a sense in which you're doing something that, from the point of view of democratic political ethics, is not okay, right? So on the other hand, you don't ask Charles Taylor and Gerard Bouchard. You know, Charles Taylor's just written a 1,000-page book on, you know, the rise of secularism, you know, since the Big Bang, and, you know, and you know, you're not going to expect a kind of administrative document from him that's just going to say, you know, we went around and we saw that there were basically everything was fine. What they decided to do, and this goes to what they decided to do was to try to figure out why there'd been this problem. Now, why questions like that do not lend themselves to recommendations that can be easily, not only, forget about bureaucratizable and resourceizable, even expressible in terms of a recommendation. There are pages and pages and pages here, which we didn't talk about very much, on Quebecois identity. It's a remarkable thing. I mean, to have this in a public document, you know, the sort of musings on, you know, there's a passage, like, what is Quebec identity? 12 points, not 11, not 13, 12 points, I think. This is what Quebec identity is. Now, in a way, that's a remarkable thing to do, but it's also kind of a remarkable naivete on the part of the commissioners to think that a government official was going to look at this and say, yeah, you know, we should do something about this. So, you know, in a way, being more generous with the government than I've otherwise been inclined to, they latched onto the sorts of things that make sense from the point of view of a government, right? That, after all, does not legislate identity, nor should it, you know, God protect us from, you know, governments that want to start legislating identity from on high. So, you know, I think that one of the problems with the report was that by opening up the mandate, it went down a path that, you know, maybe it'll be part of the intellectual public discourse of Quebec, you know, and people will read it and it'll make people reflect. It's not going to find its way into any kind of government proposal because it can't, nor should it. But B, and this is the problem, it gave rise to expectations that it couldn't possibly answer. And this is where it connects with Monique's point and with some of the anxieties that came out in the course of the commission. Once you start saying that you're going to talk about a lot of stuff that wasn't in the mandate, right, then the question is, well, why don't you talk about even more stuff? You know, where is the natural dividing line that says, well, we're going to talk about immigration? There is no point in the definition of the mandate where the word immigration is mentioned. I argued until I was blue in the face and in print about the fact that there was actually something illegitimate. Because if we want to have a debate about immigration in this society and name a commission, we would have named people other than these two people and other than the people who are on the advisory committee like myself. We would have named demographers and economists and other people. But they decided to make it about immigration. And then, you know, a lot of people rightly said, well, if you're going to make it about, you know, more than it was already supposed to be about, why not the whole, you know, Why not Aboriginal peoples? Why not, everything, every ill that plagues the society. So, you know, that's just, Chuck isn't here, but, you know, I've had this discussion with him. You know, I think that was, in a way, the sort of, the problem with the report in terms of its mandate. It was kind of doomed in a way at the outset once they decided to, doomed not in a sense of, you know, it did do something in the society, but doomed in terms of its ability to respond to the kinds of desires, pressures, concerns, anxieties that it itself elicited.
Oh, merci de la conférence. I will ask a question in French, but you can ask, you can answer in English or in French. Au fait, je pose la question à n'importe quel intervenant, puisque c'est d'ordre général, quoi. La conférence est vraiment très intéressante. Le rapport Taylor-Bouchard un an plus tard. Un an plus tard, il n'y a vraiment pas eu de changement vis-à-vis du rapport. La question que me pose, est-ce qu'un an encore plus tard, est-ce qu'il y aura le changement? Puisque c'est bien, chaque année on peut revenir ici, s'il n'y aura pas de changement, ça sera d'ordre N. Je regarde les statistiques, puisque honnêtement, le rapport, d'une manière ou d'une autre, ça me touche. Pour deux raisons. Un, ce que vous appelez minorité visible, d'abord, c'est un terme que je n'ai jamais apprécié. Minorité, bon, un intervenant parlait minorité, majorité visible. Minorité par rapport à quoi? Majorité par rapport à quoi? C'est les termes d'abord qu'il faut. Au Canada, ça existe. Je ne sais pas pourquoi. Bon, ça, c'est les termes politiques, quoi. Bon. Et il faut aussi remercier le gouvernement du Canada, puisque c'est l'un des rares pays où on fait l'intégration des immigrants. C'est déjà quelque chose de positif. Mais vis-à-vis de quoi? Parce que je suis ici un nouvel immigrant depuis environ 60 jours exactement. C'est pour ça que j'ai dit que ça me touche d'une manière ou d'une autre, la conférence. Et je suis mieux placé pour observer. J'ai fait 10 ans d'études en Russie. Dans mon université, c'est le gouvernement, bon, le gouvernement du Canada fait une politique pour l'intégration. C'est-à-dire, ils viennent dans les universités pour immigrer. Ils parlent positivement du Canada. Que ceci a le travail, ceci les diplômés, ceci, cela. Qui veut immigrer? Mais arrivé ici, les tendances sont autres. C'est autre chose. Ce que vous appelez ici emploi caché, 80%. Puisque, bon, je parle de l'emploi, puisque en réalité, le meilleur instrument d'intégration, c'est l'emploi. C'est pour cela que, d'une manière ou d'une autre, ça touche tout le monde. 80% des emplois sont cachés. Il est tout à fait d'accord qu'un nouvel immigrant ne peut pas accéder à ces emplois cachés-là. Il faut d'abord un certain temps. Bien sûr, qualifié ou non, il faut du temps. Bon, pourquoi emploi caché ici? Est-ce que la commission Taylor, le rapport Taylor, c'est bien beau, j'ai essayé de lire ça à ma manière, quoi. D'une manière, il y a l'intégration, il y a eu toutes des recommandations. L'idée était déjà bonne par le premier ministre qui a demandé, et les immigrants, bon, Taylor et Bouchard, ils ont fait une étude vraiment spécifique, bien sûr que c'était une étude politique et autre. C'est très bien beau. Mais ce que je voudrais, ma question pose pour l'avenir, quoi. Puisque autrement, on va toujours revenir même. Puisque quand je parle au salon d'emploi, on dit 25%, quand je dis ici africain, inclut arabe et musulman. Les statistiques du Canada, moi j'aime les chiffres, comme le russe bien sûr. Les statistiques montrent que le taux d'inemploi au Canada c'est environ 10%. C'est très bien beau, c'est bas ou c'est pas bas. Mais vis-à-vis de la communauté africaine, c'est environ 25%. Il y a quelque chose qui ne va pas quelque part. Deux solutions arrivent. Ou alors l'Africain ne veut pas travailler, ou alors il est incapable de travailler. Bon, là, je suis allé dans un salon d'emploi. Au salon d'emploi, je suis inquiet que me disaient que les Africains ne veulent pas travailler. Je vois plutôt, les chiffres sont inversés. 80% des chercheurs d'emploi, bien sûr, c'est les Africains. Donc, ils veulent travailler. Ils sont diplômés. Mais qu'est-ce qui ne va pas? Bon, est-ce que le rapport de Taylor dans l'avenir, quels sont les moyens mis, ne serait-ce que pour l'intégration? Ma question, quels sont les moyens vraiment un an, deux ans plus tard, quels sont les moyens mis à que cette commission normalement dans l'avenir, que c'est bien beau de faire la politique d'intégration, c'est bien. Autant mieux vraiment ne pas faire s'il n'y a pas les moyens mis en place sur ça. Je sais que c'est un problème politique et je me dis que mon souhait c'est que le rapport Taylor, un, deux ans plus tard, qu'il y ait quand même des éclaircissements là-dessus. Merci.
Well, I agree with you that these are political problems, and to reference Daniel's remarks, the commission refers to a whole host of social and economic problems to show the expansiveness of its analysis, without being able to supply the tools or the prescriptions to solve the problems for which it gives evidence, actually, and you've given us more evidence. I think that without, as I've said, without looking more critically at the problems, at more problems of social justice in Quebec, rather than just harmonization practices with respect to religion and nearby aspects of culture. Without opening it up beyond that, there's no way that in a year, to answer your question, that things will be different, except accidentally, maybe, in a way. I mean, change happens without the government, you know, necessarily facilitating it, so maybe change will happen gradually, and Tariq Madrid gave some very good statistics yesterday that seemed very promising for Quebec, or for Canada as a whole, in terms of particularly second-generation immigrants, but the 25% unemployment rate that you cite for Africans in Quebec is very similar to the rate for Algerians and Moroccans. And these are, as you say, people with degrees, with work experience that have been specifically selected to come to Quebec. And so the problem has to be addressed at that level. And as we've seen, it's not just issues, it's not only issues of equivalence, which the government has said that it will try to address. There's something else going on that they would need to look at. So I hope that there will be change in a year, but I don't know that, I would say that probably the report itself would not help address those issues of inequality because it didn't set out to do so, really. And to my mind, they don't necessarily really think that the problems on that front run so deep, despite paradoxically the evidence that they give for that kind of discrimination.
Je pense que vous avez mis le doigt sur quelque chose de très fondamental, pas dans le rapport, mais dans le contexte qui a donné lieu au rapport. Au fond, le problème le plus fondamental, je crois, et votre réflexion permet de mettre le doigt dessus, c'est que le rapport reflète les préoccupations de la majorité culturelle. C'est-à-dire que, au fond, pour la majorité, le fait qu'il y ait 25% de chômage africain, ça pose pas vraiment un problème. Nous, on n'est pas en chômage. Hein. Ce qui pose problème du point de vue de la majorité, c'est les kirpans, c'est les choses qui, lorsque les gens qui ont d'autres pratiques religieuses veulent se joindre à nos pratiques, que ce soit des matchs de soccer, des cabanes à sucre ou autre chose, en infléchissant ces pratiques de leur manière de faire. Ça pose problème du point de vue de la majorité. Le problème, et ça c'est un problème auquel je n'ai pas de réponse et qui me rend pessimiste, parce que ce n'est pas le rapport Taylor-Bouchard qui va toucher au problème que vous avez identifié. Il faudrait une autre commission d'enquête qui, elle, mette vraiment l'accent sur la question de savoir pourquoi nous avons tant de chômage. Bon, maintenant on est dans une crise économique, mais même au moment où on était en théoriquement plein emploi, pourquoi il y avait quand même tant de chômage dans les communautés, vous n'aimez pas le terme, mais je vais quand même l'utiliser, de minorités. Et ça, c'est une préoccupation qui n'est pas une préoccupation encore de la majorité. C'est une préoccupation des minorités et le poids dont disposent les minorités pour dire au gouvernement, maintenant, vous allez accorder 5 millions de dollars ou je ne sais pas combien, 10 millions de dollars à faire une grosse enquête sur la question de l'inégalité dans la distribution du chômage. Hein, le poids politique dont disposent les minorités est beaucoup moindre que celui dont dispose la majorité pour dire vous allez faire une enquête sur des questions de kirpan et de voile et de pas de porc dans les cabanes à sucre. Le problème est trivial comparé à celui que vous avez identifié. Et quand les consultations régionales sont arrivées à Montréal, vous n'étiez pas encore arrivé d'après ce que j'ai su, mais quand les consultations régionales de la commission sont arrivées à Montréal, tout d'un coup le registre a complètement changé. Plus personne ne voulait parler de voile et de kirpan et de machin. Tout le monde voulait parler et le refrain L'intégration, c'est par l'emploi. On l'a entendu à Montréal tous les jours, dans toutes les bouches, de tous les. Alors que dans les régions, c'était un discours qui était complètement absent parce que ça ne correspond pas à leurs intérêts. Donc, c'est quelque chose de. C'est très pessimiste comme conclusion, mais c'est la majorité qui dicte ses préoccupations au gouvernement et c'est en fonction de ses préoccupations qu'on décide de faire les commissions qu'on fait. Je ne sais pas exactement quelle est la solution à ça.
I'd like to make some comments about race and racialization, though I have to say that my brief was to say something about secularism, so I've really only read Chapter 7 of the report and only just glanced at other parts of the report. So I want to say something about racialization in the light of what's been said so far and not about what the report does or does not do, because I don't know about that. And I guess I want to say, and this connects with what Eleanor said a few minutes ago, that there are different kinds of racisms, and we have to be alert to that, and I think we have to be alert to the changing nature of racism and not be blind to some changes by holding on to out-of-date kind of sociological models or theoretical models of what racism is. So I guess the classical kind of idea of racism, certainly in, you know, in the kind of Atlantic world, is that a group of people are different from another group of people because of their biology. And they're visibly different because they may be black, one group may be black, another group may be white, but their behavior or their intelligence or something or the other is different because of what we now say is their genes, but what in earlier centuries would have been referred to in some other biological way. Well, it seems to me that, and I'm really very much focused on the experience of a country like Britain and some of the neighboring countries rather than, say, Canada and the USA, but some of the most significant, prevalent, and rising forms of racism in my part of the world can't be captured by that classical idea of biological racism because and this isn't just all to do with 9/11 and Muslims and so on. It's a bigger phenomenon than that. People from South Asia in Britain, so this includes Hindus and Sikhs, not just Muslims, there are various stereotypes held about them by the majority population. But, I mean, stereotypes like they work too hard, they're too religious, too family-centered, they don't know how to have fun, and things like that, which have nothing to do with biology, but they're very prevalently held. Any opinion poll will show that they're prevalently held. And people believe that there are things deep in their culture that makes them behave the way that they do. So we have a case of where people are identified phenotypically, because people can say someone's an Asian from across the road without... regardless of what they're wearing or anything like that, and certainly not knowing anything about, you know, their cultural practice, like did they have an arranged marriage, but they can say someone's a nation on the basis of their appearance. But the stereotypes that do the work of separating out, to use the what Eleanor was saying about logic of segregation, and meaning not here residential segregation, but, you know, separating out one population group from another population group, and therefore, as it were, the process of group construction, what's doing the work are perceptions about culture and community norms. But these are supposed to be very deep, perhaps unchangeable, and certainly ones that only a few people from that group can escape from. And then you might say, well, what about the case then that people have perceptions like that about another group, but where the phenotype doesn't play any role at all? And you might say that about, say, Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland. They had very strong stereotypes about each other, but most Catholics and Protestants can't tell who is Catholic and Protestant just from appearance. When they open their mouths, they usually can, because the accent's a big giveaway. So we talk about visible minorities. Here we have audible minorities, because, you know. And then they have strong beliefs in play. And on the whole, we tend not to use the word race about that. Locally, the conflict was referred to as a sectarian conflict. In India, we talk about communalism and casteism and so on. So phenotypes and biology are playing no part, on the whole playing no part. But on the other hand, the kind of culturalism, the cultural determinism and so on, is very similar to the case that I gave. So I think if we use race to describe all those processes, it becomes unhelpful, because we ought to be able to distinguish between some kinds of isms and other kinds of isms. So my own suggestion would be that we hold on to the idea that we're talking about race when we use phenotype as an identifier of the group, but not the idea of behavior being determined by something biological. And that then allows us to see that we have phenomena that we could call cultural racism, or if we like, religious racism. Because Muslims then can be partly identified on phenotypical bases, but the attitudes and the behavior to Muslims can be shaped by perceptions about something to do with Islam or something to do about Muslim community norms and so on. And I think that's the kind of phenomena that we've got. Some people in Europe, including the European Union officials and politicians and so on, talk about Islamophobia, which I think is a less adequate concept, because that assumes that what's doing most of the work are perceptions about Islam. And while perceptions of Islam are certainly relevant, I don't think they're doing all the work. Pakistanis and Bangladeshis in Britain and Algerians and Maghrebians in France and elsewhere and Turks and so on were experiencing racial discrimination before anybody thought about them being Muslims. But on the other hand, it is the case that the hostility against those groups of people has been aggravated, has increased. And this includes discrimination in the labor market, but other kinds of hostility, including to do with cultural practice and asking for permission to build a mosque, planning permission, and all those kinds of things where religion comes in. So we certainly don't need to choose between, oh, is it racial discrimination that's the problem, or is it something to do with cultural practices or perceptions about Islam or Muslim identity assertions and so on, because actually they're all implicated and they can be mutually reinforcing and making the problem greater than the sum of its parts. And so we need a much more complex and multidimensional analysis. But certainly, I would agree that we mustn't lose sight of racism, because that often is, certainly in my part of the world, that is, if you like, is the first floor on which the rest of the building is built. So we mustn't forget that foundational element, but nor can we ignore that the the assertion of religious identity and practices and so on can become part of the problem. And perhaps one of the ways that, you know, if we want to do empirical work on this, we might think about testing. To what extent is it kind of perceptions of religion that are leading to hostility and discrimination? What about other things? Is one might want to see to what extent people who are what we might call visibly Muslims beyond the phenotype are treated compared to people who are Muslims just in terms of phenotype and community membership. So that, as far as I know, no systematic research has been done on this, but certainly I suppose I would begin with the intuition and therefore the hypothesis that of, you know, 20 Muslim women applying for a particular job in a workplace, let's say in a bank, something like that, the Muslim women that would be wearing the hijab are more likely to have discriminatory questions asked of them, like the ones you were quoting about those men quoted in the report. You know, are they fundamentalists? Are they extremists? Are they zealots? Are they sympathetic to bin Laden and so on? Much more like to have those kinds of questions asked. And if those questions aren't asked, they'll be in the minds of the interviewers, of the selectors, and therefore will be influencing the decisions and so on, than the other Muslim women who, you know, might not be so visibly Orthodox Muslims and therefore have the suspicion of all the other suspicions that I mentioned, and similarly in the case of men and beards and things like that. But what I don't think we should lose sight of is that the discrimination about that people have about, let's say, Muslims, will not only be to do with people who hold certain religious views or practice certain religious customs and practices, because on the whole, the interviewer, the bureaucrat, the person making the decisions, whoever they are, will not really know that's the case. All they might know, say they receive an application form in the post or online, or all they have got is a surname. And what we do have evidence of in Britain, and I'm sure this is true in Canada as well, is that a lot of discrimination takes place on the basis of surnames. So if someone perceives a surname to be Muslim, that will be a ground for discrimination, and they don't know anything about that person. That person actually could be a very anti-Islamic person in the way that lots of Catholics are anti-clerical or anti-Catholic. But they don't know that. So the phenomenon of anti-Muslim racism, cultural racism, is a wider phenomenon than just that of religious hostility. But the religious hostility can both aggravate it and concentrate it onto certain individuals. But the discriminator often doesn't have a very good sense of boundaries, especially if they play conservative, meaning play safe, better to discriminate against more people and keep out the person you want to keep out than to let them in. So unfortunately for them, Hindus and Sikhs in Britain suffer anti-Muslim prejudice and discrimination, even where they share it. They'd suffer from it, which of course makes them very angry. So Sikhs and Muslims, you know, we have our own histories of enmities and so on, but it so happens that a turban-wearing, long-bearded Sikh man looks more like a Muslim than I do, and if we are walking down the street in London, is more likely to attract anti-Muslim verbal abuse than I am, and so on. So obviously they're not going to be very happy about that. And the harasser, the abuser, doesn't mean to attack the Sikh. They're saying what they are, thinking they're a Muslim. So similarly with surnames as well. A lot of anti-Muslim discrimination hits Hindus because people can't tell the difference between a Hindu surname and a Muslim surname and so on. So I think that the phenomena is complex, and we don't need to have a race versus religion, what's really doing the harm, what's really the source of anxieties and so on. Debate, because they're both relevant, and of course the balance between them or the forms of interaction between them can change over time. These are empirical questions. We shouldn't just kind of have a view about them as, well, you know, race is always more important than religion. Well, no, that's not the case. In many parts of the world, like India, for instance, you know, genocides and programs and massacres and communal riots and so on can all be based on perceptions about religious community membership and so on. So we shouldn't have an a priori view about what ism is doing the work. I think we need to appreciate change, complexity, and have ways of operationalizing those concepts in order to do empirical research.
Bonjour. Je vais répondre en français à l'intervention de monsieur en arrière. Alors, mon nom est Michel Turenne, je travaille à la Commission des droits de la personne et je m'intéresse aux questions, enfin, je travaille sur les questions particulièrement d'égalité en emploi et accommodement raisonnable. Je vais vous donner mes impressions, soit au niveau des interventions, des plaintes qu'on reçoit et aussi des élèves, des étudiants que j'ai à l'Université de Montréal dans un cours qui s'appelle Accommodement raisonnable, entre autres. ce qui arrive, qu'on réalise au niveau de l'emploi. Premièrement, au niveau de la définition de minorité visible, qui est une définition qu'on pourrait appeler, entre guillemets, discriminatoire, si je peux abuser du terme, c'est que ça catégorise les gens en fonction d'eux-mêmes, alors que la catégorisation vient de la perception des autres. L'UNESCO a, enfin, dans les derniers rapports concernant la discrimination au travail, on propose plutôt de parler du terme groupe racisé, groupe racialisé, parce qu'on se trouve plutôt dans un rapport de pouvoir plutôt que dans un rapport de race. Alors donc, pour revenir à l'intervention de monsieur, alors donc, que ça soit religion, race et tout, alors donc, c'est plutôt un problème de rapport de pouvoir. On n'a qu'à voir qu'en Afrique du Sud, les Noirs étaient majoritaires et c'était eux qui étaient exploités. Alors donc, c'est plutôt, ça se situe plutôt dans un rapport de pouvoir. Deuxièmement, ce qu'on réalise aussi, et moi de ma propre expérience en tant que personne issue des minorités, c'est qu'il faut être là à la bonne place et être solidaire. C'est de plus en plus ce que les personnes issues des minorités, que ce soit les autochtones, les personnes noires, les personnes asiatiques, les juifs, les homosexuels, etc., au lieu d'attendre tout du gouvernement, disons on est dans une société néolibérale, on ne peut pas se fier à tout ce que le gouvernement va faire beau en toute vertu, parce que la réalité est que le gouvernement, comme a dit monsieur tout à l'heure, le gouvernement travaille en fonction de la majorité, travaille en fonction de qui va voter. Quand on a fait les lois d'accès à l'égalité, les programmes, les premiers étaient par rapport aux femmes. Mais les femmes composent 50% de l'électorat. Donc ça bouge. Équité salariale. Les gens vont parler de ça, pour ou contre. Et les employeurs, pour ou contre, patronat, pour ou contre. Mais finalement, ça marche quand même pas mal. Pourquoi? C'est 50% de l'électorat. Quand on a des gens issus de l'immigration, bokeh agglomérés dans la région de Montréal, très peu en région, alors comment voulez-vous qu'en vertu de vœux pieux, qu'on arrive à des résultats. Alors donc, raison pour laquelle de plus en plus qu'on réalise, que je réalise aussi dans le milieu, c'est que les personnes issues des minorités racialisées ou discriminées se retrouvent entre elles et créent ce qu'on appelle du réseautage. Quand monsieur dit 80% des emplois ne se retrouvent pas, on ne les voit pas, c'est parce que ça se voit par réseautage. Et le réseautage, malheureusement, peut créer des ghettoisations positives ou négatives. On va dans le secteur éducateur, éducatrice de garde, très peu payé. On voit de plus en plus de Maghrébins. On va dans le secteur de l'hôtellerie, de plus en plus de personnes issues d'origine latino-américaine. Pourquoi? Parce que, bon, pour toutes sortes de raisons, que les Québécois blancs souches, si je peux abuser du terme, vont moins là. On trouve le problème maintenant pour les travailleurs agricoles, le problème de la grippe maintenant. Je vais vous donner une anecdote très triste. J'étais dans une conférence jeudi sur l'accommodement dans le système de santé. C'est un médecin de Québec qui a présenté l'anecdote très triste. Je ne sais pas s'il y en a qui en ont entendu parler, de 12 personnes d'origine latino-américaine qui se sont présentées dans un CLSC pour le check-up régulier qu'on fait lorsqu'on est nouvel arrivant. Et tous les gens du CLSC ont dit on ne veut pas être là en présence d'eux. Et le responsable a proposé que les Mexicains et les autres latinos qui étaient avec eux, enfin, je ne sais pas si c'était que des Mexicains, reviennent à un autre moment où le CLSC serait fermé. Alors donc, voici où on en est au Québec, et ça s'est passé il y a une semaine. Alors donc, c'est ça la réalité. Mais ces latino-américains, ils viennent faire un travail qu'aucun Québécois de vieille souche voudrait faire, parce que c'est trop dur et pas assez bien payé. Alors, donc, c'était pour vous donner un peu mon propos là-dessus. Alors, donc, on va les prendre, les Latinos, les Africains, les Arabes, mais où les Québécois de souche, vieille souche, ne seront pas là. Et parallèlement, c'est les gens issus des milieux, des sociétés, des groupes discriminés qui, parallèlement, doivent se regrouper entre eux, faire de la pression, faire du réseautage, faire du favoritisme entre eux. Ce n'est pas politiquement correct, mais c'est comme ça que ça se passe.
Just I wanted to add something to Islamophobia, and is the question is a general question that when I talk with the here from in North America with the people, is that the low knowledge about the people are outside of here. They don't know about the people here. The knowledge is very low about the people. For example, the first just one example. I can't tell everything in this example. At first, they ask you, where are you from? You say, I'm from Iran. He says, so are you, in 98% is, are you Arab? So I say, why did you ask the question? At first, I say, I'm coming from Iran. The second question is, are you Arab? How do you know about the geography of this world? He said, oh, because you are Muslim. You are not Arab. So the judgment is from the criteria is the religion. They categorize the people from the religion. So the religion is very important here. Maybe because of the low knowledge about what's going on outside and the geography, the knowledge about the people. The media is the influence of the media and the people, Islamophobia, assault, and then they categorize the people on this criteria.
I think several of the last comments have pointed out just how what a social and political process naming groups is, and particularly naming visible minorities. Michel pointed out, is very much about having the power to name, as you said, the UNESCO report comments, so that we mustn't lose sight of that, and that it's not enough just to say, yeah, okay, whatever, but let's just keep saying visible minorities. To have these definitions exposed from the imposed from the outside is its own kind of political oppression, really, and we mustn't lose sight of that. And I like the recommendations that we complexify our understanding of race and racism. I want to just quote one sentence from the report that I think lends credence to Tariq's suggestion that we need to think about cultural racism and not be too indebted to an older model of sociological model of racism, which is really outdated. On 238, the report says that we must always be wary of imputing to racism certain attitudes or remarks that in actual fact stem from collective insecurity, or more precisely from the exploitation of this insecurity. It seems to me that there's a tendency in the report to treat racism as this thing over here, which is a deep ideology that requires reflective or higher order endorsement and is therefore fairly rare, and that all of these forms of cultural racism, which are really pretty endemic in the institutions and the everyday practices, and I don't think Quebec is unique in this in any way, but that for which we have a lot of evidence around unemployment, inequality and discrimination in housing, which hasn't even talked about, and that with a broader, more critically and politically savvy definition of cultural racism and all the permutations, that would be able to address some of these issues that are coming up and that the commission itself raises.
I really appreciate Tariq's very helpful analysis, but it allows us to say that there can be competing and different racisms operating at the same time and in different registers. Tariq offered us as the dependent variable of interest how much job discrimination one finds, how much unemployment one finds. But from the perspective of justice, we also care about the dependent variable, how many violations of religious freedom are there. That is of independent interest. And while there can be a racialization of religious minorities that contributes to their deprivations of religious freedom, in a way that, there would be a coherent sense of the word even in saying that Western Canada and the Western United States racialized Mormons in that sense of identifying a set of cultural stereotypes that fed into a series of nightmare stories about how awful things were that meant that things had to be prohibited. If there had been a large fundamentalist Mormon population here 2 years ago, then it seems to me we could have said there's a phenomenon about religion that encompasses practicing Muslims, practicing Orthodox Jews, and practicing fundamentalist Mormons, and that those conversations have something deep in common with one another that they don't have in common with the kind of structural racism that means that Christian and secular and Muslim, Africans and first-generation immigrants from the Middle East and first-generation immigrants from Iran mean that they suffer significant job discrimination and unemployment. So that those could both be racisms, but they could be racisms that are different and draw on different sources of sentiments and different populations. And it seems to me that we would still want to be able to analyze the first in a way that emphasizes its religious character and doesn't conflate it with the second.